Hello and a very warm welcome to Political Economy with Shweta Punj. India will soon go in for elections and there is a lot of excitement and anticipation. The one thing that's always aroused my curiosity and of a lot of others who follow the India story is how does India manage to conduct elections on such a large scale? A country with a billion plus population, a country with far-flung remote areas which still are not as easily accessible through roads and highways, they are all mobilized into casting their votes. Most importantly, India's elections are conducted in a free and transparent manner. Something a tall order, actually, that not a lot of countries can boast of today. I have with me today Mr. Ashok Lavasa, who has been the Chief Election Commissioner of India, who has been closely integrated with this entire election process. Thank you very much, Mr. Lavasa, for joining us. I'm looking forward to really getting a deep insight into how do you all plan these elections? There's so many things that you have to look at, whether it's the logistics of it or the fact that, you know, the election needs to be conducted in a very transparent manner. So first things first, how long before the election, the polling happens, how long before do you start really preparing for the process?
Thank you, Shweta, for having me over. And if I may just make a little correction, I was election commissioner, not the chief election commissioner.
Okay, apologies.
So that's just for the sake of putting the record straight, although as you know that the election commissioners, all of them are on an equal footing. So in terms of involvement in conducting the elections and understanding the affairs of the organization, we are all there. So to your question on how far before the elections do we start preparing? So I guess the preparation time for a general election, the kind of which is impending in 2024, and a state assembly election that is also conducted by the election commission, the clock starts ticking at different points in time. So for a general election, it might be a revelation to you and to your viewers that election commission has a calendar of every milestone that it must cross and achieve before the D-date. And this calendar could go back as far back as 365 days. So there is meticulous planning on all fronts, different aspects of the that go into the organization of elections are mapped. And if I may use, there is some kind of a panchang which is created where every activity is dotted. The responsibility of the person who has to conduct that activity is marked. And that's how the whole thing is monitored and you reach a situation where you become prepared. Well, the fortunate thing is that generally, in a general election, the rough timeline is known. So it helps in planning when there is no midterm election. So that way there is a little bit of predictability and that goes into supporting your ability to do a rational planning.
Interesting. So for instance, we have general elections coming up most likely in May. So the election commission would have started work on this since mid-2024 or even before that?
You mean mid-2023?
Sorry, mid-2023, yes.
Yeah. So you see, there are two different dimensions of conducting the elections. One is something which happens day in and day out, which is the maintenance and updating of the electoral rolls. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the electoral rolls are the heart of the process. Mm-hmm. Because unless you have a robust, clean, updated electoral roll, then the voters' rights don't get enshrined in your documents. So one aspect is the preparation of electoral rolls, which keeps happening day in and day out. Now, as you know, that earlier the cutoff date was only 1st of January of the year in which the elections would be held. But now the parliament has legislated that there are four cutoff dates. So
Okay.
any new voter who's eligible on the 1st of January and then every quarter, he is entitled to become a voter and entitled that his name gets into the electoral roll. Otherwise, the previous dispensation was that, for example, those attaining the age of 18 after 1st of January this year would not be eligible to cast their vote. So now that system of updating has become a little more rational. So that is one aspect, the preparation of electoral rolls. And the way you make these rolls, the draft rolls, public, you invite objections, and then you again do deletions and addition till virtually a few days before the poll date. So that is one aspect. The other aspect is planning the logistics. And there, it would be interesting for you to know, Shweta, that, for example, in the 2019 elections, there were more than 1 million polling stations which were established for casting votes. And we were, and we were catering to a voter strength, elector strength of 910 million voters. So that is the magnitude of the exercise which the Election Commission of India conducts. And when you look back in time, you find that when the first elections were conducted in 1951, we had a voter base of about 170 million.
Gosh.
17 crores. And the number of polling stations which were established were just about 100,000. And the voting went on for about 4 months because the the times were such, logistics were different. And now, of course, things have changed. So the Election Commission does all this preparation before it actually gets to finalizing the schedule for polling.
Wow. So what are the things that you keep in mind when you decide on the number of polling booths that you need? And what are the basics that go into a polling booth, the must-haves?
So there are various factors which determine the establishment of polling stations. There are some cardinal principles that the Election Commission follows. Generally, it is felt that you shouldn't have more than 1,000 voters per polling booth. The figure could go up by 10% here or there, depending on the strength in a particular polling station. The other principle that Election Commission follows is that voters need not have to go too far, maybe not more than a kilometer or so, to cast their vote. That is what, so accessibility of the polling booth is an important point. So due care is taken to see that all these polling stations are friendly for people with physical disabilities. So the PWD voters constitute a very important segment as far as the planning is concerned. Every polling station must have facilities for getting into the polling station if you are physically challenged. So that is what we keep in mind. And then the polling station has to be in a public building. It generally is never set up in any private building. That is another thing. We also make sure that to the extent possible, you have polling stations at the ground level so that there is adequate space for election, the candidates and their agents to establish their booths outside the polling station. There is a way in which people can get in to the polling station. They can form queues. There is facilities for drinking water, etc. So all that is taken into account. And you also know that there is a proper process of verifying the identity of voters before they get into the polling station. So you must have space where this can be done. All these are taken into account before we finalize the location of polling stations. And it is not as if that these locations are not known. The locations are known, they're publicized, so that if anybody has any objection to the setting up of a polling station, he or she could object. Political parties can give their view, and then the final list is made.
Okay.
Also, one other aspect which I want to cover here is that Election Commission has for many years followed a system of categorizing some polling stations as sensitive polling stations.
Mm-hmm.
So, for whatever reasons, historic reasons, if the perception of the Election Commission is such that there is likely to be more tension, more political sensitivity in a polling station, then to that extent, Election Commission takes adequate safeguards and security mm-hmm. arrangements at that polling station.
Okay. So, I want to go back to one of the points you'd made earlier, that there's a list of tasks that's demarcated for every for an individual or for a department. So how many departments are involved in this whole exercise, and what are the kind of tasks that are there on your to-do list before conducting the elections?
So the beauty of the Indian elections is that the constitution makers were so farsighted that they created a lean and thin body, but vested in enormous authority. So as you know, there are five or six articles in the constitution which establish and empower the election. And they have complete authority on the conduct and superintendence of elections. So Election Commission by itself would be a body of about 500 or 550, 600 employees. But it has the authority to take assistance of any government department that it feels is necessary to do. And therefore, in this setup, you have the Election Commission of India, that every state has a chief electoral officer who works under the Election Commission. He is a permanent authority. He or she is a permanent authority.
Yeah.
But below the chief electoral officer, every district magistrate or collector or deputy commissioner, as he is called in different parts of the country, he is designated ex officio as a district electoral officer.
Right.
And below him, as a permanent authority, there are officers who are empowered as EROs, who are electoral registration officer. And I explained to you that they have a job to do as far as upgrading and updating of the electoral rolls is concerned.
Right.
During elections, you have returning officers, assistant returning. So that is the crucial, critical machinery. But other than that, the police, which is responsible for providing security, the central armed police forces, which work under the guidance and supervision of the Election Commission during the period of the poll, and many other agencies, which are enforcement agencies and support agencies, they work with the Election Commission for doing all the planning. Let's take the example of railways. So moving people from one place to another, because as you know, Indian elections are conducted in phases, and people need to move, forces need to move. So when will the forces be able to be relieved from one place and go to another? All that is part of this plan.
Yeah. So we've spoken about the organization bit. Now I want to move on to, every elections, we get these news reports on EVMs getting tampered and so on. Where do these EVMs come from? Can they be tampered as easily as, the politicians would or claim that it can be easily done? Is it that easy to tamper an EVM?
So, first question was, where do the EVMs come from?
Yeah.
The electronic voting machines, they are manufactured by two public sector undertakings, which are under the Department of Atomic Energy and the Ministry of Defense. So they are the two sole manufacturers of EVM.
Mm-hmm.
And for the purposes of establishing the manufacturing process, mm-hmm. Election Commission is guided by a technical experts committee, which comprises of people who are very proficient, well-known in their fields. So mm-hmm. they are the people who are the technical conscience keepers of the electronic voting machine and all the other systems that are attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
All machines which are manufactured by these two companies in their various units, they are monitored very systematically. So every machine is coded, and there is a way in which the Election Commission tracks every machine. In respective districts, the district magistrates are responsible for the secured storage of these machines. Mm-hmm. So before the polling schedule is announced, an assessment is made of how many EVMs would be required in every district. And mm-hmm. due care is taken to transport these EVMs in a secure manner under the protection of the central security agencies mm-hmm. and with full disclosure to the political parties that so many EVMs are moving from one place to another. So the mm-hmm. entire logistics chain mm-hmm. pertaining to the movement of EVMs is in full public knowledge. So that is one. Mm-hmm. That is one. As far as the storage and mm-hmm. security is concerned, you have CCTV cameras, everything is recorded, and there is a police, central police guard, which is guarding the storehouses. During the elections, when the election process begins, then whenever any EVM is taken out of the store,
mm-hmm.
it is after informing the political parties. And if the candidates have already been finalized, then they are also duly informed. No functionary connected with the election process
mm-hmm.
is authorized to touch or deal with any machine without informing political parties.
Okay. Okay. So political parties are kept in the know. Right. Mm-hmm.
So there is an arrangement, administrative arrangement,
mm-hmm.
under which a lot of safeguards have been provided.
Mm-hmm.
As far as demonstrating to the people is concerned, at different stages, when the EVMs arrive in the district, mm-hmm. there is a first level check, which is done in the presence of political parties. And there are test votes which are cast in every machine to show that the machine is working properly.
Okay.
And then, of course, when the machines go to the polling station on the day of the poll, before, let's say about a couple of hours before the scheduled time of poll, there are more polls conducted in which 50 votes are cast, including a vote, and verified with the VVPAT slips and shown to the agents of the candidates that this is functioning as per procedure. So that is the protocol which has been prescribed by the Election Commission
mm-hmm.
for handling these machines and for their safe upkeep.
Okay. So when during elections or after elections, when we hear allegations that EVMs have been tampered with, are political parties making those claims on the basis of some evidence, or are they making it because it's just political rhetoric?
No, sometimes what happens is that there are misgivings which happen,
mm-hmm.
or there would be some error made by somebody by way of carrying a machine, not following the due procedure. So whenever any such incident is noticed, it gets publicity, and it is not as if that in a machinery, in an election process, which involves about 13 to 14 million people who are involved in this process of conducting the elections. So there could be lapses on the part of these individuals. And these lapses, whenever they are reported, Election Commission has a system of responding very quickly and taking remedial action.
Mm-hmm.
I think the effort on the part of the Election Commission is that it should be swift in responding, mm-hmm. but it should also be very sure. It needs to investigate into any allegation properly before it responds and comes up with its own version of what it thinks the truth is. So I don't say that there are no complaints. There could be complaints.
Sure.
But all that I'm saying is that there is a system of addressing these complaints.
So 13 to 14 million people are involved in conducting elections. That's just a mind-boggling number. And how many EVMs? How many EVMs are deployed? Say in 2019, how many EVMs were deployed? And do we see the number of EVMs getting deployed going up with every successive election?
Oh, that's a good question. I would not want to hazard a guess, but mm-hmm. I suppose there would be 3-4 million EVMs.
3-4 million EVMs. Okay. Okay. So we have been talking about this one nation, one election. You know, logistically speaking and practically speaking, how doable is that? Just purely from an organizational aspect.
I think the Election Commission has already put forward its views and its requirements in terms of managing a one nation, one election arrangement. And it is obvious that the number of personnel involved will go up because you will be having elections both to the state assemblies and the parliament at the same time.
Right.
The number of polling personnel, the number of machines, all that will go up. So I don't have the exact figures
sure.
which Election Commission has put forth. But it is quite clear that it will, at one point, the requirement will go up. And obviously, the obsolescence of these machines and their replacement will accordingly be influenced.
Mm. Okay. In terms of cost, Mr. Lavasa, how much does it cost to conduct an election, a general election?
I think the figure for 2019 was probably it costs close to 100 rupees per elector.
Okay.
So if you had 910 electors,
mm-hmm.
the expenditure incurred by the government would be close to 9 to 10,000 crores. Because you see, this expenditure happens at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So the official figures I don't have right now, but that is the number that I have read in number of places, that if you put together the government expense in conducting a general election, then it's to the order of about 100 rupees per voter, per elector.
Mm-hmm. Per voter. That's per electors, no. Per voter.
No, there is a difference. An elector is a person who is enrolled.
Ah,
a voter is a person who casts his vote.
Sure.
So you have, let's say in the last election, the voting percentage was somewhere close to 68%.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make your numbers out of so many 94 crore people, 68% cast their vote. So that would be the number of votes.
Ah, okay, okay. So, you know, we have elections coming now in 2024, in the summer of 2024. Any lessons that India can learn from across the world, or any lessons that India can offer to other countries in the way it plans for elections and executes them?
See, there is a reference to the Indian election process being mm-hmm. referred as a gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Because the kind of planning which goes into conducting this election And clearly, there is no other parallel in the world when you have this scale and size of the election.
That's true. That's
I
true.
think one of the biggest strengths of the Indian electoral system is A, the legal arrangements which govern the elections, and B, an elaborate set of instructions. So if you were to look at some of the most systematized operations in the world, or some of the industries which have a very elaborate and detailed standard operating procedure. I mean, take the airlines, for example. Airline has an SOP for everything. Similarly, Indian election system has a very comprehensive standard operating procedure. Every conceivable eventuality has been imagined and a procedure prescribed for that. So I think that is one of the biggest
Can you
strengths.
share some of those eventualities that have been accounted for in the SOP?
I mean, for example, how do you handle a machine? How do you open the machine? All that procedure is given. How do you set up a polling station? What should be the size of the ramp which should be made for PWDs? So everything is laid out in the manual of election procedure. Election expenditure, how do you monitor violations? So all those things are laid out. And what I'm saying is that this is followed by a very organized training program. So the entire machinery which is involved has to go through repeated training so that they are not only updated, but they keep refreshing their knowledge of the procedure that they're eventually supposed to follow. So I think these three things are the vitals of the Indian electoral machinery.
And who conducts this training? This is also done internally by the EC.
Yeah, it is done by the Election Commission of India and an institute which they have set up called the Triple IDM. That institute is primarily responsible for conducting the training.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lavasa, for that master class on the art of conducting elections. Great insights in there, and I'm sure for one, I'm completely in awe. I've always admired how we conduct our elections. But today, just I'm a lot more informed about the process and the thought that goes into ensuring that every little detail is thought of. And I think there's so many lessons for all of us there, business leaders who are building organizations and individuals who are trying to do multiple things, for instance. Thank you very much. And of course, we will be in touch with you during the elections. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shweta. And I just want to end by saying that the citizens of India should try and know as much as possible about how elections are conducted and what kind of planning, what rights do they have, what responsibilities they have in the conduct of elections.
Maybe we'll do a
Thank you.
part two on this one, the rights and responsibilities. All right. Okay. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank
Bye.
you.